Hey, everybody, welcome to the afterword. Ruth, you got to help me. How do you want to be introduced? Because we've got, you just got married.
I just got married 3 months ago.
So do you want to be,
I have a new last
name. Are you hyphenated? You're not hyphenated, but you have a new last name.
I have a new last name.
Yes. Bet.
And Bet Avaz. So Ruth Bet Avaz is my new name.
But Nazanin is.
Nazanin is now is my still middle in there. Name.
It's now your middle name.
Yeah.
So Ruth Nazanin Bet Avaz.
Or just call me R&B.
Oh, that's amazing. I've never R&B.
Yeah.
Oh, that's fantastic. Welcome.
Thank you.
Well, we're here on the afterword. We're here talking about one of the great passages of the New Testament, which you preached on at our Saratoga campus. Jay preached on at our South Hills campus. An incredible passage on Philippians chapter 2 in humility. So let's talk about humility.
It's levels to it. You and I know. Tell them be humble. Hold up. Sit hold down. Hold up. Hold up. Be humble. Hold up.
So who's the most arrogant celebrity or the most arrogant celebrity story you've ever heard?
I think we just got to go right into it.
Which is who?
And mention Kendrick and Drake.
Oh.
The most arrogant group of rappers I have known to this day.
Because they seem more arrogant to you than any of the predecessors going before.
I mean, for sure, there was arrogance leading up to people like Drake and Kendrick. But
what is it that strikes you with their beef as being more arrogant in the world?
What I find so interesting is the fact that Kendrick received almost a compliment from Drake, J. Cole, Weeknd. Like, hey, like we're the top dogs.
Right.
And Kendrick was like, absolutely not. There isn't a group of us. There's one of us and it's me. And it's Kendrick Lamar.
You're like, right. You're right. For those of us
that are tuning in that don't know.
Here's the thing. We could do, and I think we should do, an entire full length, long form deep dive into this rap battle between Kendrick Lamar and Drake. We don't have time for it. But not basically today. Here's what happened. And on the drive back from Waco, my son and I spent a good 3 hours listening to every single diss track, every single iteration of it, and then going through all of the pieces of it. But in essence, J. Cole, a rapper, said, hey, there's the big three. It's me and Drake and Kendrick. And Kendrick comes out and says, in essence, screw the big three. There's the big one, and it's me. One.
Yeah.
And that's how this whole thing started. Mm-hmm.
And here we are.
And you think that's arrogance? Or, I mean, it just sounds like arrogance. It's got to sound
like arrogance. It's pride. It's
right.
A lot of things that maybe he needs to work through.
So we see that played out in this cultural moment. And kids are watching. We're watching. By the way, I can't take my eyes off of it. It's like, there is something about the clash of egos that is fascinating, right?
Yeah.
So why is that, I wonder?
I think it underlines insecurities and the fact that we can collaborate with one another, that people like Kendrick and Drake and J. Cole can come together and collaborate and make even greater work that is put out into the world for people to listen and consume. That is much harder. And I think people don't want to commit to that time, attention, and energy, and ultimately the humility aspect of it.
Right.
There may be someone at this table that I'm sitting with that has a gift that might be different than mine. That can move the ball forward.
Right. So you're saying, now, I wonder, do you think that we're less humble as a society because, or not because, we'll get to the because later. Do you think, I mean, in your time growing up, do you think that humility has vanished more as a virtue than when you were growing up? Or do you think it's always been an issue and we're always going to be battling this because we as humans are self-centered by default because of our sin nature? What do you think?
I think it's always been an issue.
Sure.
We just see it in different forms. Now we see it in diss tracks. But I think from the very beginning, it's been an issue of my heart and your heart and everyone else's selfish or self-interest that we want to push forward. And so you know, there's this visual of climbing this ladder. And if anyone or anything got in the way of that, you're, you know, being elbowed in the face and totally pushed aside.
Right. And this is before your time, but in the 80s, they actually called it the rat race. The climbing the ladder, climbing the corporate ladder. Greed is good. This was the ethos in the 80s. This is before your time, long before you were born. Mm-hmm. So it's been around since at least that. And it's just now, it seems like it's just a different iteration.
It's just evolved.
Become a Instagram influencer, get more likes, get more followers, right?
So now it's evolved now into more of beauty. How do you dress? What do you sound like? Who are you hanging out with? Who are you listening to? So now there's more of this form that if you don't fit into this mold of what it looks like to be someone who is visually appealing or you sound, again, the things that I listed, then you're totally pushed out of the way. And again, those self-interest, the self-agenda gets rooted into relationships, friendships, even work environments.
But I mean, you and I grew up in vastly different decades, you know, but we knew about popularity. You knew who the cool kids were in school. And the thing about the cool kids is the cool kids hang out with the cool kids. Right. Were you a cool kid, by the way?
I was not.
That doesn't make any sense to me.
I sat in the hallways. My first day of ninth grade, I could not find any of my friends, which were only two people that I knew in the entire high school.
And how big was your high school?
We had about like 1,500 seniors that would like graduate, 1,500, 2,000 seniors. It was huge.
That's gigantic.
Public high school. Yeah, yeah.
That's 8,000 students in your high school?
That's a lot.
That's bigger than any high school in the Bay Area. I think Independence High School is the biggest high school in the Bay Area at like 4,000.
I could be missing.
That is so big. Yeah. What was the name of your high school?
Cleveland. Shout out Cavaliers. Valley.
But not in Cleveland.
No.
We're in SoCal.
The San Fernando Valley.
In the San Fernando Valley. What city? Partake.
Northridge.
Northridge. Oh, yes. Northridge, yeah. So it was Cleveland High School, named after Grover Cleveland, the former president. Yes.
Yeah. So our mascot was a Cavalier. So my first day.
Just like the Cleveland Cavaliers.
Yeah, yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Your first day of ninth grade, 8,000 people
I couldn't
roaming.
Find my two friends.
Of course. How could you?
And I don't have a cell phone at this time.
Of course.
So I had lunch in the bathroom.
No.
Just like the movies.
No.
I think in my mind, I was like, let me just do what I've seen done before in the movies and the shows was just go have my lunch.
You didn't want to sit alone at a table?
I didn't want to be seen as a loner.
How long did that last? Did you find your friends the next day or?
We had a hard conversation. I said, please don't ever leave me again. And so I think a little bit of my control as a 13-year-old, 12-year-old was like, I don't want to be left alone and isolated.
Sure.
And so I gave him a time and place and, you know,
oh, man.
He showed up the next day.
Yeah. That's incredible.
It was humbling.
But we saw my point with that popularity thing is we've all done that. Like the idea of popularity is you only hang out with people who are higher or equal to you.
Right.
Never lower.
Never.
And if we're honest, it's the same today. So that was high school in the 70s, 80s, 90s, 2000s, and today. I sound like a radio station. The best of the 2010s and today. But it's the same thing in the Silicon Valley with businesses in there that you tend to only partner with. Stocks are basically popularity contest. Mm-hmm. You know, it's basically image and, you know, which stocks are being associated with, you know, so-and-so has a deal with this company. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of a modern climb now, but as you talked about this weekend, this is actually not the way of Jesus. No. And actually, this actually dehumanizes us. So talk about how it dehumanizes us or how you've seen it dehumanize people or even do some bad work in you as you wrestle with some of those impulses. How does ladder climbing or only associating with people at the same level as you and higher for self-aggrandizement and upward mobility and advancement, how does that harm us as humans?
I think as we're trying to climb up these ladders, whether it's in our educations, in our careers, in our relationships, whatever that may look like for each one of us. We're climbing this ladder and it feels really good because we're seeing these accomplishments happen. We're moving the ball forward. We are being promoted, you know, elevated to the next level. But in result of that, the dehumanization of our souls is that we experience burnout and so much exhaustion.
Oh.
And, you know,
Because we're not meant for it.
No, we're not meant for it. It's like a game of Marco Polo. Have you ever played Marco Polo?
Yeah.
I hated that game growing up, but my friends always wanted to play because someone's it. They're calling out Marco. Everyone else is running around in the pool, swimming around, responding, but also having to like not be chased down by the person who's it. And so you're calling out Polo, but you're burnt out. I was the one that would always try to quietly swim out of the pool and stand on that solid ground because I would get so winded. And so climbing up these ladders in our society and our culture today, we are responding, but we're so exhausted. We are calling out, Polo, Polo, yes, I want more. Give me more. I'll do more. I'll be more. I'll dress better. I'll sound better. I'll do anything just so I can stay on the same level as everyone else. And because now I'm hanging out with people that are higher than me or above me, it just makes me want to chase that even more. And so at the cost of my own well-being, at the cost of my own soul, I find myself burnt out, exhausted, and just needing some solid ground. And Jesus' invitation for us is to really descend from that ladder, to, you know, in Philippians 2, in the poem, it's really to become nothing. Jesus became nothing. And being even in the very nature God, he, you know, represented who God is. And the invitation from God the Father is to just as to descend and become nothing and empty ourselves with any self-interest, any self-agenda that we may have. And that is when we can experience life and life to the full.
It's interesting because one translation, I forget what it is. I think it's NIV says became nothing and ESV says emptied himself. They're just the same thing. And there's a sense that Jesus is laying aside. He's not grabbing. He's not ladder climbing. He's laying aside, I guess you could say aspects of his divinity or the full benefits of his divinity.
His greatness. His
perfection. Yeah. He's Gary Brashears, who was my mentor. I wanted to run this by you. He had an analogy. I wonder what you think of it. He said, tell me how this hits you. Okay. Cause this is the first time I've shared this with you. He said, imagine that there's a hotel baron and he owns all the hotels, right? And his son comes and his son knows that the hotel, he knows how the hotel's built. He was there when it was built. His dad's the owner. He's got a key card that can open any door in the entire hotel, right? And that's his son. And then he puts that in his back pocket and then he gets checks into the hotel with a single room key. So he's got it in his back pocket because he's got the master key. He's the hotel builder and owner's son after all. So he's got it in his back pocket, but he never uses it. He only uses a single room key, just like, you know, everybody else. Does that help or does that not help? When you hear that analogy, does that help or does that not help?
Absolutely. It's becoming this outward expression of what's internally happening. And internally, what is going on in us becomes basically what we put out there for others to see. And for, you know, the son to put that key in his back pocket shows that transformation that's happening from the inside out to become like every other guest that is in that lobby
is to descend yeah.
is to become on that same level as everyone else, and all the while knowing, okay, yes, I have this key in my back pocket, but I'm not going to use that to get myself ahead or to, you know, show it and shove it in everyone's face who I am or who I belong to or what I have in my hands. I think it's that act. It's the act of what Jesus even did for us.
But this is, I love what you said, but it is counterintuitive. You say we're exhausted from ladder climbing, but then the invitation is to serve, which is effort. I mean, it's not like it's not effort for Jesus to, I mean, it's not like it doesn't cost Jesus something to leave heaven, to come to earth, to spend all those years on this dusty planet, serving, giving, teaching, healing, working, than dying, right? It's not like that's not effort. Yeah. So it's counterintuitive that this is the way to life. You know what I mean?
True.
So, yeah. But you've had people in your life who have descended for your benefit. So like talk about, because I think that if we get lost in in ourselves. if we think about, well, what's in it for me? I think we're on the same track, you know, so you know, people who have been humble, you know, people who have descended on your behalf. So who's somebody that has descended on your behalf that when you think of humility and this kind of Christ-like, I'm going to lay aside or empty myself for someone else's benefit to serve and love them. Who comes to mind when you think about it?
Yeah, receiving the gift of humility from someone in our lives is, there's truly nothing like it. It puts things into perspective. And I remember, and I've shared in this space before, when I lost my dad at the age of 10, I also had two siblings that experienced the same thing. My sister, who was 10 years older than me, she was 19 at the time. She was a sophomore in college at CSUN. And
CSUN is Cal State University Northridge. All right, yes. Not everyone grew up in the Bay in or the in, this, Valley. In the Valley. Sorry.
Yeah. So she was on her way to transferring from CSUN to actually move here to Silicon Valley and attend San Jose State. And so when my dad was sick and when we learned that he will no longer live after a couple of weeks of finding that out, she had a decision to make. And actually, her last conversation with my dad, I remember her telling me this, was that, hey, I want you to go. My dad sat her down in the hospital room and said, no matter what happens here, I want you to move and go to San Jose and get your, you know, degree and go after your career and your life. Don't stay here. Don't let this hold you back. And as my sister described that whole moment in that room for me, she had told me that I looked around the room. I saw our brother. I saw our mom. I saw you. I was 10 at the time. And she said, there's no way I can go. And so she actually put her education on pause and she stayed back.
Wow.
And her intention.
Stayed home.
She stayed home. She stayed home and she helped my mom raise me because she wanted me to have some sort of normalcy as a child growing up.
Wow.
And you know, I feel like I'm forever indebted to her because of that as my big sister. And we reminisce on it many of times because a part of why I even got here is someone stayed back. Someone put their agenda aside, their dreams, their education, everything that they wanted for themselves. They put that aside for me to be able to, you know, to grow and to grow up.
And, right. And to heal and to have normalcy
and to have a sense of family.
Yeah.
And so my sister isn't the only person that has done such a thing. You know, we all have at least that one person or that one story that maybe someone has shared that has sparked some glimpse of this reality that Paul is inviting us into.
Yeah.
That Jesus set the ultimate example for us to descend from this ladder of what culture thinks is success and greatness and self promotion into a descent to a community of people that are considering each other. And he says, this is how you're going to see this play out, is when you do this for one another. You know, he starts the entire poem with that.
Right.
This is how you're going to see your relationships flourish within the church community, and even going out to loving our neighbors is to consider the interest of others before ours.
So I know it's probably hard for you to speak for your sister because mm-hmm. she's not here, but I would imagine she would say something like, if I had a choice mm-hmm. to make a different decision, I would not make that. So what flowed out of, or why is that life and life to the full? Not what is it about the descent, about the decision to serve other people? What is it about that brings life and life to the full? Because it's counterintuitive, right? Yeah. You would think she's giving up so much, it's got to be a deficit. But she, like, even as you speak about it, it's like, no, this brought life to me, to my mom, and to her. So it's like, it's counterintuitive, right? So what is it that brings life? Is that just the way that love looks? Is it becoming more like Jesus?
Great question. I think for our family, what my mom experienced was peace. Like, okay, my daughter, my oldest daughter is going to stay home and she's going to help me. There's a sense of peace that comes along with it. And then for our family, it was just this beauty of our family coming together and staying stronger. There was unity between us. And those are the things that stay. Those are the things that stick longer than a feel-good moment. And I think that's what, you know, we even see in scripture. When we love one another, when we extend the hand to help, it's bringing this bond that is so much stronger than my selfish ambitions of wanting to reach somewhere. And when I get there, I'm even more anxious, more in a panic, and I'm isolated. I think when we descend from that ladder, we experience a sense of deep community with other people. And it's not that kind of a community where, okay, you scratch my back, I'll scratch yours. No, that still is out of a self-interest. It's putting that
That's aside. Networking. Right. That's networking, right? Right. Exactly. That's not, this is not the kind of family exactly. Paul's talking about.
Yeah, Paul is inviting us to this posture of laying down at the altar our selfish intentions, our desires to our own greatness. Yeah. In exchange of that laying down of the altar, what we receive is people that are also practicing this, what do you call it? Just this act of love that is so much greater than ourselves.
Yeah. The thing it also reminds me of, or as I reflect on what you're saying, it's like we're, I think we dramatically underestimate how much we need each other and how much we're made for one another as humans. Mm-hmm. I think that in a disconnected age of atomistic individuals where we think that our lives are our own and it's just about us and ourselves, or maybe our smallest family unit, maybe if you're married or have a roommate or girlfriend or boyfriend or something like that, or a best friend, maybe it's just like a small community, but really what we're made for each other. And I think we dramatically underestimate how interconnected we are and need to be. Yeah. And I think that humility is the only way that that human community really works.
Agreed. And I think when I think of humility, I'm like, oh, like it feels like such a big posture. Like it's a huge posture that I cannot approach because mm-hmm. I don't know where to begin.
Right.
And so what has helped me is to ask myself, where is my time going? Where is my attention? Where is my energy going? When I look at my calendar, how much of it is filled with my own plans? How much of it is filled with my own self-care, which is needed in healthy boundaries to take care of ourselves and to do that is important. But to also spend time and being honest with ourselves of where is our time going? Time is the most valuable thing now more than ever before.
Yeah.
And I can tend to get really selfish with it.
Yeah.
Have you ever been in a place where when someone, one of your friends has made plans with you and they have to cancel the day of?
That never happens to me.
That never happens because everyone wants to hang out with you. But that happens
never.
To me.
No, it never happens because I never have plans. That's what it, no. So, right. And then you get mad.
And then either you get mad or nowadays I feel like whenever I've had a friend cancel on me, I have found myself to get a little like relieved. Like, oh, good, I got an hour and a half back. I'm being real honest here.
Oh, wow. Okay. You
know, like, oh, good, I have an hour back to myself.
Yeah.
I'm like, okay, I got to check my heart there. Like, oh, shoot.
Yeah.
Like, there's something here that I need to now reflect on right. and bring back at the altar to Jesus.
One of the things that's hard, I think serving, because the invitation is to use your life and your time in part and in full in service to God, right? And service to others. So, because Paul is like, I want you to have the same attitude as Christ Jesus. Like, this is how he starts this community. He's like, serve each other the way that Jesus served us, which is, he's the model in this. So I think that's going to require our time, energy, and attention. And I just think that that's a hard ask. I think a lot of people in the Bay Area, I've heard this before. I remember one time this guy said to me, like, look, I'll give you all the, ask me for money, that's fine, but don't ask me for my time. And I was like, why? And he's like, I'm not going to give you my time. I don't have time for that. I'll give you my money. I support what you guys are building here, but I'm like, but then you're not going to be a part of it. You're just a spectator who threw some cash at a thing.
Right.
Like, this is about being transformed and being a part of the, like, if your sister had moved to San Jose and said, I'll send a check for $1,000 a month. Like, what? I mean, yes, that would have helped, but sure, that's not what you needed.
Not what it's about.
That's not what it's about. It's not about that. It's about the being a part. And your sister wouldn't have been transformed by that experience either. So there's jumping in and being a part of it. Maybe there's a, I'm an only child. So like the idea of family is like so important to me because I didn't have brothers or sisters growing up. My parents were only children pretty much. And my dad had a brother that was like disconnected from our family, but my mom was an only child. My dad was basically an only child. I was an only child. So I didn't have that kind of, and then in the church I found, oh, this is family. And that's been a big deal for me. It's probably been more important than it should be, frankly.
And in all these years, you're absolutely right. In all these years that I've been even at Westgate, I have seen glimpses of this being carried out into our church community. Because we really, when we say we're family, like we're family here. And I remember when I was in student ministries at the time supporting the teams. And we were coming out of COVID and we were trying to launch our first summer back. And many of our leaders transitioned out for whatever reason. And so we all stood in our student lounge at the Saratoga campus and we asked, how are we going to pull this off? And so with prayerful consideration, we put the word out there and the church family responded. And we had new leaders come in and spend the summer with us, with the students. We launched summer camp where you taught, and the outcome of it was just this beautiful story of young people saying yes to Jesus and also leaders becoming mentors for these students. And many of those leaders have still stayed to this day, and it's been several years. And so that transformation that you see in one person, it's just a ripple effect. It catches fire quick. And so I want to be a part of what God is doing in the life of students, for example, or, and you know, as we see people take their next steps. For me as a next steps director for Westgate, it's such a joy to be able to see people start somewhere and journey through, you know, their discipleship process and get to a place where now they're using their gifts and what God has given them to serve other people.
Yeah.
And that is the vision of what we see here in Christ's poem in Philippians 2. And I think that's living life to the fullest, to how God intended it to be.
Yeah, the church life, the family life, all those are things. But this also has some deeply personal edges. Like you said, it makes me say, how am I living this out? Like, because this is surgery. This passage is death to self. And death to self is never easy. And I don't think, Steve Clifford used to say all the time, people never give up power, position, money or authority without the Holy Spirit. And this is giving up those things, you know, and it's giving up time. It's giving up, you know, all sorts of stuff. So what are the edges of this verse? What is it doing like in you personally? I'll go first just for, not because my story's better, but there was so this humility thing, there is a thing that I read from C.S. Lewis, and this is, I was reflecting on humility. And C.S. Lewis's book, Mere Christianity, has a whole section on humility. He says, do not imagine that if you meet a really humble man, he will be what most people call humble nowadays. He will not be sort of a greasy, smarmy person who is always telling you that, of course, I'm nobody. Probably all you will think about him is that he seemed a cheerful, intelligent chap who took a real interest in what you said to him. If you do dislike him, it will be because you feel a little envious of anyone who seems to enjoy life so easily. He will not be thinking about humility. He will not be thinking about himself at all. If anyone would like to acquire humility, I think, tell him the first step. The first step is to realize that you're proud. And that's a big step too. At least nothing, whatever, can be done before it. If you think you are not conceited, it means you are very conceited indeed. I love what he says, that being humble is not about thinking of yourself less, but being humble is not thinking less of yourself, but thinking of yourself less. So here's how this comes out. Oftentimes in social settings, I come in and I'm pretty big and I'm pretty loud and I talk, and there's not a lot of space sometimes for me, for other people to talk. And so one of the things I'm learning is there's a time and a place for that, to make people feel comfortable, to set the room, to be fun. But there's also times when I need to shut up and just say, tell me about what's going on. Instead of telling that story that I needed to tell, you know, tell something, let space for other people. And that's both in my own family, where my daughter, who is very, my son's very loud. And so we can get very loud back and forth and we can just go and go and go. But my daughter's very quiet. Yeah. And I have to like stay like still, and then she'll land like a butterfly. Mm-hmm. And I have to be like super quiet. And so that's humility. I have to do that in pastoral spaces and social spaces and our team staff. Humility means being more interested in what other people have to say, as opposed to that fun story. By the way, I have an incredible story about a skunk I need to tell you, but we'll share that later. Anyway, so that's for me. And that this is what this means, because it's about, why do you need to share that story? It was because it's funny. Why do you need to share it? Because it's funny, because then people will laugh. Why do you need to laugh? Because then they'll like me. Do you see what I'm saying? It goes into all my core insecurities and dysfunctions. So that's where this verse has been super challenging. And that's in every personal interpersonal relationship. So I share that not to be the first person to share.
No, thank you.
So what are some edges for you as you think about this?
Yeah, I love to help people solve problems. And sometimes that gets in the way of a friend or even my husband. Sometimes he'll come home after a long day and he's in cybersecurity. So there's things that he can't even share about what he's doing, but it gets overwhelming and he gets overwhelmed. And
he's in cybersecurity. So there's a sense in which he's like, hey, what'd you do, honey? I can't tell you.
I can't tell you. I'm like, great.
There was an attack. We prevented it.
Exactly. Literally every conversation at the dinner table. But he'll come home and he wants to vent and just share his thoughts. And I want to feel like I'm being helpful. So immediately I'll chime in and suggest, hey, tomorrow when you go in, let your boss know that you should do X, Y, and Z. Immediately I go into problem solving because I want to make sure that he knows that he's supported and that I also feel like I'm needed. And he's gently reminded me, like, Ruth, what I need from you is just a listening ear. And I've caught that in myself where I am a verbal processor. Sometimes, you know, these episodes can go really long because we can sit here and just process everything out loud. But it's at the cost of a loved one in front of me or even a church member that is just wanting a listening ear. And those are the small steps that make the biggest difference. Is realizing what is needed in this space.
That's interesting. You said you're a verbal processor and that's like your default, but you like put that aside, empty yourself of it for the benefit of Eden, your husband. Yeah. Because that's kind of what he needed. So in a sense, it's an emptying of itself. It's like, hey, I process verbally. So there I am. That's what I do. I need to process verbally. And there's, well, I don't need that. So it's like you're kind of putting yourself, you're emptying yourself and your need to verbally process out to serve him.
And it's not even, yeah, exactly. And it's also just this the sense of pride that I have in wanting to be the person to help you figure out what you need to do.
Ah, yes. Yeah.
And it's not about me.
Well, you know so much about cybersecurity. I'm sure you're
so much. You have no idea. I have a separate degree in it. yeah. So I think putting aside my pride in that Eden doesn't need to hear what I think. It's not about what I think in this moment. It's about what Eden needs to release out and put it out there for me to just listen. Yeah. And so those little actions have really been helpful for me in those moments with people that just want a listening ear.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We're going to close just by reading this. This is, again, this is one of the great passages of the New Testament. Mm-hmm. This is one of the, I say this a lot and I say this probably too much. If the Bible is a mountain range, this is one of the peaks. This is an incredible verse. So I'm just going to read it. Therefore, do you want to read it? Why don't you read? You've got a better voice than I do. So Philippians 2, I'll wait till you pull it up. We can edit this. This is, no, you don't have to be sorry. It's hard to type with those incredible nails. Ruth, you can't see this, listeners, but Ruth just got her nails done and is it a French manicure?
They convinced me to do a French.
Yeah, they're fantastic. And you, so if you see her, check out her nails. Anyway, go ahead. Read this passage because I think it's awesome.
Yes. Philippians 2. Therefore, if you have any encouragement from being united with Christ, if any comfort from his love, if any common sharing in the Spirit, if any tenderness and compassion, then make my joy complete by being like-minded, having the same love, being one in spirit and one of mind. Do nothing out of selfish ambition or vain conceit. Rather, in humility, value others above yourselves, not looking to your own interests, but each of you to the interests of the others. In your relationships with one another, have the same mindset as Christ Jesus, who by being in the very nature God, did not consider equality with God something to be used to his own advantage. Rather, he made himself nothing by taking the very nature of a servant, being made in human likeness. And being found in appearance as a man, he humbled himself by becoming obedient to death, even death on a cross. Therefore, God exalted him to the highest place and gave him the name that is above every name, that at the name of Jesus, every knee should bow in heaven and on earth and under the earth, and every tongue acknowledge that Jesus Christ is Lord, to the glory of God the Father.
Mm. Awesome. Ruth, thanks for being here.
Thank you, Dave.
Yeah, we'll talk to you soon.
Talk to you later.
Just want to say thanks to Ruth for stopping by, and join me next week where we'll be continuing on in the book of Philippians. And I've got a treat for you. Our new South Hills campus pastor, Archie Jackson, who I get to work with now on an almost daily basis, is going to be here in the studio. It's his first time preaching at our South Hills campus. So we're going to be chatting it up. I cannot wait for you guys to meet him. He is awesome. So, and very cool. Like Ruth, very cool. Anyway, join me for that, and we will see you next week. Hey, everyone. So the afterword is over. And I know I just talked to Ruth about how one of the movements of humility for me is to leave space for other people to talk. So I'm going to completely violate that and just talk for like 9 minutes straight. But I wanted to share a story with you. And the reason I'm sharing this story is because I think it's a great example of being humbled or humiliation or something, or perhaps humility. I don't know. So anyway, here it is. And I hope you enjoy it. All right. This is just for kicks and giggles.
Oh, I love kicks and giggles.
You ready? Okay, I'm going to tell you a story about humility.
Yes.
Here's something that happened to me. So it's Friday night. Mm-hmm. I have a funeral I have to do Saturday.
Oh, gosh.
So, and it's a tragic situation. Yeah. A young man who died in our community. Mm-hmm. Real, real sad. But my daughter is just done with school. So she's got her friends over, sleepover, yeah. Girl sleepover, very fun. So they're there. Yeah. They're all getting ready for bed.
Swift in the background.
Yeah, I'm sure. Yeah, glitter everywhere. You know, the hair in the sink, whatever. So it's 11:45. It's almost midnight, and I'm tired. I'm gonna be honest with you, Ruth. I can't stay up till 2 o'clock anymore. I don't go clubbing hardly at all anymore. I know. So I'm there, and my daughter's like, "Hey, Dad, can you take the dog out to go to the bathroom for the last time?"
I love Jack-Jack.
Right, Jack-Jack. So I have a sentence. I say, "Hey, Jack-Jack, pee-pee for night-night. Pee-pee for night-night." So, and he knows exactly. He knows exactly what that means. It's time to go pee-pee one last time for night-night. So, you know. So I go, open the back door, and he goes out in the yard. Now, as I look out into my backyard, I notice there's something, and I see a ball. On my patio.
Okay.
Our neighbor kids had been playing basketball and the ball had flown over our fence and had rolled all the way in front of our patio. So I'm distracted by the ball for maybe 2 seconds, mm-hmm. 2.5. I reach down, grab the basketball, and I turn to walk toward the fence to throw it over.
Sure.
As I turn, I see in the corner of our yard, in the corner of our fence, in the corner, boxed in by our house and our fence and our back fence, mm-hmm. there is an animal.
Stop.
And Jack-Jack sees the animal, and the animal is black and white.
Oh, gosh.
It's a skunk. And I know in a second what's going to happen. Jack's like, "Oh, look, a friend."
Oh, no.
I'm telling you, Ruth, I yelled at... I did not have a volume control on my voice.
Yeah, at 11:45.
At night, the entire neighborhood must have heard me scream, "No, Jack, no!" And it was, it was like, "No." And I could not. And so I don't even know what I did with the basketball. I think I dropped it. And I ran after Jack. And of course, he's like, "Hey, friend." And what do dogs do when they say hello to their friends? The skunk is scared out of his mind because he can't get away. Skunks are terrible crawlers and climbers, I guess. So
they're the worst.
And so he's there, and so I run as fast as I can, but it's too late. And Jack's faster, and so I see him get sprayed in his mouth. And I see him like back away, like, what the actual heck is going on here?
Right.
The skunk then sprays again on his like kind of neck collar area.
Oh my gosh.
And then my hand comes in, grabs Jack, and then I put my other hand, and then the skunk turns and sprays me squarely on my hand forearm area. And then turns and does another spray. I'm wearing flip flops. Kind of in the leg general area. I'm telling you, Ruth, this is not... Have you ever experienced a skunk spray?
No, they don't come around Middle Easterns.
Oh.
Yeah.
They just know. You best
We're
not.
We're a different breed.
You best not. I will cut you. Oh, so, you know, you smell the skunks, and it's a bad smell. Yeah. That's not what this is. The skunk smell up close when it just happens... If you think about the skunk smell, that is diluted sometimes from miles away in the wind. Stop. So think about what that's. It's not a smell. It is like a chemical weapon. It's not so much a smell as it is a chemical that makes your entire olfactory system shut down. So Jack begins retching.
Sure.
I'm not saying I'm retching. I almost do. It's not a smell. It's like my eyes are watering. It's like tear gas. I grab the dog, run to the front yard, and I'm yelling. Now I'm yelling a lot. Our neighbor across the street, she's a young woman, just graduated from college. Mm-hmm. She lives with her folks. She's like, what's going on? And I'm like, Jack got sprayed. JL and her friends come out. And I'm there, and it is the smell. And JL immediately is like, oh, man. So I wash him off, and I'm like, now is he hurt? So our neighbor actually calls the emergency vet, says, hey, yeah. is there something that needs to happen? Does he need to be brought in? And they're like, do not bring him in.
We don't want him.
And they're basically like, it's not. If he got in his mouth, that's fine. He'll spit it out. Wow. He'll have some violent digestive reactions, but he's fine. Just wash it off and use Google skunk removal. You know, the skunk removal formula.
Oh, okay.
So I was told growing up it was tomato juice. Have you ever heard that?
I think so.
It's an old wives' tale. It's a lie. It's a lie from the pit of hell.
Okay.
Basically, I have a white dog. If I had used tomato juice, he would be a pink dog. He would be made fun of by all the neighborhood dogs.
All the other dogs.
But what you do is you take hydrogen peroxide,
okay,
baking soda, and Dawn or liquid detergent. So the liquid detergent gets rid of the oils and helps them dissolve and get off the dog. But then the hydrogen peroxide and the baking soda forms a compound that dissolves the acids or interacts with the acids that the skunk has sprayed,
yeah,
which are horribly pungent, and turns them into harmless, non-smelling acids. So
this is all happening.
It's a chemistry.
At midnight.
This is happening at midnight.
And then the skunk just ditches you.
I don't know where the skunk is. And to be honest, I called him an Uber and I said, get out of here.
Bye.
For the next 2 hours, I am giving this dog like shower after bath in this like little Costco tub. He's miserable.
That
it's freezing.
Humbling.
And no, here's the worst. Oh. We didn't have enough hydrogen peroxide. We only had one bottle in our house. So I've been sprayed by a skunk. I walk into Safeway at midnight to try to buy all their bottles of hydrogen peroxide. And people were looking at me. They were giving me 10 feet on, and I'm like looking, I'm sorry. I'm very sorry. I do bathe. I'm a hygienic person because people expected like, oh, that's a skunk smell. No, it's not a skunk smell. It's like this chemical. And they're like, the heck is wrong with this guy? I'm very sorry. I was just sprayed with tear gas. I'm very sorry. And people are like, and so the clerk is like backing away.
Checkout.
Yeah. It's closed. There's closed because it's after midnight. I bought 8 bottles of hydrogen peroxide and, you know, we gave him baths until 2 a.m. At one point I was like, girls, don't touch him because if the oils get on your hand,
Then you're done for.
You're done because it seeps in your pores. So I get rid of all this stuff. I give him 10 baths and then I can't have him sleep with the girls because he smells too bad. So I have to sleep with Stinky Dog.
Yeah.
There is actually de-skunking shampoo. But it's only at the pet stores.
I'm buying you for your birthday.
No, but they don't open till 9 a.m.
Yeah. And you have a funeral the next
day. Okay. So I sleep with the dog that way. I can't go into my bedroom. It'll wake up Nicole. she slept through the whole thing. It's great. So I'm glad for that.
I love that for her.
So I know I love that for her as well. I blow up an air mattress, go into her office, and then turn on some fans and open up all the windows. I can barely sleep because the smell keeps waking me up. Jack is like, he's actually traumatized, so he just wants to be near me. Yeah. But he smells so bad, and I'm like, what is going on? So the next morning, I wake up. I'm telling you, my hands smell like, so I had to go buy this de-skunking shampoo. I took him to the groomers, an emergency groom session. I said, can you de-skunk him? They said, yep, we can do that. We'll give him the baths. We have the chemicals. Yeah. We have the shampoo. I go and take the de-skunking shampoo. I take it home and I lather up my entire, I have a funeral. I can't smell like skunk at a funeral. I lather up in dog shampoo, de-skunking dog shampoo, to get the smell out. And I say, because you got to leave it on your skin for 10 minutes. It's kind of burning. It's like a chemical peel. It's for a dog. It's not for a human. It's strong enough for a human, but made for a dog. So so that's what I do. I just take multiple showers and by the way, it works. This stuff really does work. Okay, it neutralizes it.
I'll be sure to pick it up myself
so,
too.
But anyway, so that is my humiliating story about being sprayed by a skunk.
There's no climbing up ladders in this story.
No, there's not. It's only bad and down.
Only bad and down.
And
I'm so sorry you went through that. That's super traumatic.
It was a little traumatic, and thank you for saying that. But yeah. I'll tell you why I did it. My daughter and my dog, who I love, and so.
And for Nicole to sleep peacefully through the night, I love that.
Yeah, well, that's.
I think that's my favorite part.
Well, that's, yeah. I think that was her favorite part as well.
I'm sure JL really appreciated that.
Anyway, that's my story.
Thank you for sharing.
Yeah, thank you for listening.